Good noon, everybody. Hello. Good noon. Good noon. Hello. Hello. Good noon to everybody. What a wonderful crowd. It's nice to have an overflow, and they're standing at the door waiting to get in. That's wonderful. So, but we're going to get started because what we have is 1 hour and a half. And as you all know, the rules of the game here are the first half hour is going to be dedicated to our guest speaker. We're very privileged to have Dr. Eric Hilliner with us today, and I know you're going to enjoy his presentation and his insight into this big global problem that we have in the world. So, but before I proceed, I understand as chairperson today that I have to do a few duties. First of all, to introduce myself, race speaker, I've been a member of parliament, and I think I know most of the people here in the room, and nice to be with you again today. Secondly, the cost of the dinner today, as you know, is $10 per person, and if you'll designate someone at your table to collect the $10 for us, that would be very much appreciated. I'd like to remind all of us that the Southern Alberta Council of Public Affairs is a non-profit organization, and the way it has existed for the last, I believe, 40 years, if I remember correctly, is on the basis of the contribution you make at dinner and the membership that you may get at the outside table sustains this organization as a viable public affairs medium for us here in this community. I would like to recognize certain people at this time. First of all, the University of Lethbridge for its support in its advertising of our meetings and promoting it on campus. And secondly, that we want to thank the Country Kitchen for catering for this occasion today. So we appreciate them very, very much. I saw Mr. Campbell just walk in the door. Maybe everybody doesn't know this, but our good friend Mr. Campbell was the original person to start this organization way back in the 1970s, and it's still flourishing very well. So he planted a very good seed. So welcome. So to outline the format again, Dr. Hilliner will speak for the first half hour, then we'll have our dinner for the second half hour, and then the third half hour will be questions, and we'll break promptly and right at the 1:30 period. So I'd like to introduce the two guests that we have with us here today. First of all, I'd like to introduce Dr. Bettina Cinerelli. Would you like to stand, Bettina? Bettina is from the Trudeau Foundation, which is sponsoring Dr. Hilliner to be here today, and it's a new organization. The Trudeau Foundation is only 6 years old and has as its purpose the support of fellowships, mentorships, and scholarships for a variety of people across Canada. Some 150 people have benefited from the organization in the last 6 years, and it has grown quite significantly and gained prominence in developing public policy and debating public policy in and across our nation of Canada. There are four purposes that the Trudeau Foundation has. One is to develop public policy on human rights and social justice. Secondly, to look at responsible citizenship. Thirdly, to look at Canada in the world. And fourthly, our humans, ourselves, and ourselves in our natural environment. And as I said, the foundation has sponsored fellowships and scholarships and mentorship. Dr. Hilliner is a fellow. I'm working with the Trudeau Foundation as a mentor. My student is in Stanford University, a young scholar, a very fine young gentleman that's doing research, and my job as a mentor is to bring him from that academic world out into the real world of responsibility, and Bettina, as our supervisor and director, has said, we've got to get that job done. And she's here to check me out to see whether I'm doing it or not. So that's a bit of an introduction of the Trudeau Foundation that is part of the sponsor here today. Now I'd like to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Eric Helliner. Dr. Helliner is an expert in the global economy and global finance. Now, we started to plan his trip to Lethbridge about 3 months ago. And at that time, if I'd have said to all of you here, and we would, I don't think I said to you, we're going to talk about global finance. Our economy was okay. There was nothing wrong. I doubted if too many would have turned up at that point in time to hear that Trudeau lecture at that point in time. But what we did, and we did it just so that we would have a turnout today, we decided that we would create a global economic crisis. So that we would have this turnout today to hear Dr. Helliner give us his views. Now let me tell you just a little bit about his background. Dr. Helliner is got his PhD at the London School of Economics, and he has written a number of books on this whole subject of global finance, global economics, that are available for us to read. One of the very important things that he has been doing lately, because of his expertise, he is part of the group of people that have been advising the G20 leaders of our world. President Bush, as you know, just in the last 2 weeks has called 20 of the main leaders to Washington, and they're looking at ways and means by which to resolve this financial crisis. Dr. Helliner was part of the group to give advice to that group, and so we're very fortunate to have him here today with that up-to-date current information that looks at the problem and also looks at some of the solutions. Dr. Helliner last night at the university spoke to 130 people, and his topic was, does money make the world go around? And in his research and in his findings, I'm sure he will explain that further today. He said there is another side to the story. There is national policy. The leaders of our countries, in terms of their policy, are part of not only economic growth on the world scene, but as well responsible for creating an economic crisis. But Dr. Helliner, I'd like you to come forward and speak to us at this time.
Well, it's a real honor to be here. Thanks very much for the invitation. This sounds like a wonderful organization. It's been going on for 40 years, if I understand correctly. That's quite a record for an organization of this kind, so congratulations. I don't have very much time, so I'm going to get right into what I want to talk about. As Ray mentioned, the meeting which happened last weekend of the G20 leaders was really quite a unique moment. And for someone like me who's been studying this for a long time, this is a moment we've been waiting for, in fact, which is a meeting where you could get heads of state of the major countries in the world. So the G20 countries represent about 90% of the world's GDP. So this is really the most powerful economies in the world. Get them together and try to figure out if there can be some common answers to why this crisis has happened and what can be done about it. And the expectations leading up to the meeting were, I have to say, varied. There were many people very nervous in that the issues that have to be discussed around this crisis, some of them are extremely complex, extremely technical issues. And the meeting was called with 3 weeks' notice. Normally, if you have a meeting of this kind, you have preparatory meetings with the experts and their advisors, and this goes on for several months before they get to coming anywhere close to calling a meeting. And this was done because of the emergency situation in a much more rapid manner. And I think I mentioned this last night to those of you who were at the talk, that there were certainly some senior bureaucrats I know who were very worried about the extent to which the leaders would start talking about things that maybe they couldn't know. It's just too complicated to know. But in the end, I think the meeting was quite successful. I have to say I'm quite encouraged by what happened. One of the things we were quite worried about was, would the meeting turn into essentially a finger-pointing meeting where the Chinese and the Japanese and perhaps the Brazilians and the Argentinians would say, this was your fault, America. You had these subprime mortgages that went wrong, and you have to clean up the mess. And we worried that that might then generate a reaction from George Bush saying, well, it wasn't our fault. It was the fault of the Chinese for lending us too much money in the first place. It produced a bubble. And it was quite easy to imagine a situation where the discussion became quite unruly in terms of finger-pointing. And this did not happen at the meeting. It was really a genuine sense of let's move on and try to come to some solutions. So what I want us to talk about very quickly is to go over the major issues that were on the agenda of the G20 meeting and to try to explain to you what was accomplished, but also to explain some things that were not accomplished. Maybe I can begin just by mentioning that, you know, the central question was underlying at least the discussions was, why did this happen? And I was struck a few days before the meeting, Queen Elizabeth was being shown around some new buildings that, in fact, my old alma mater at London School of Economics. And in the middle of being shown around, she just turned to the interviewer and said, this is a school which is supposed to study economics. Can you please tell me, this is the direct quote, if these things that caused this problem were so large, how come everybody missed them? Why did nobody notice? And that is a very good question. In fact, the professor who was showing her around was stumped. He said, I have no answer to this question. And that's the question that was being asked in Washington. Why did nobody notice? Let me try to go over three central agenda items, each of which involves an interpretation of why this happened, and out of which comes some explanations. So let me begin with the first one. The first set of explanations, which I think everybody agrees on, about why this crisis happened, was that the people who operate in financial markets made a set of very serious mistakes, compounded by the fact that regulators fell behind in recognizing what was going on in markets. In other words, there was a kind of a regulatory failure combined with a market failure. And if you try to think about what exactly that market failure was to begin with, it was a process which the technical term is securitization, where you took these subprime mortgages, so mortgages that were being taken out, especially by poor people in the United States. And normally a bank would give a mortgage and it would hold that mortgage and expect a repayment in 5 years' time or 20 years' time, whatever it might be. But in this case, they took the mortgage and they began to sell it to a third party. And the third party began to buy 20, 100, 500, 1,000 of those mortgages and began to divide them up in very complicated ways, saying, I can package these together and produce a new financial instrument that I can sell on to a fourth party, and so on. And as people began to sell these products, the origin of what was underlying the original product came to be obscured. People forgot that in fact there was a home loan underlying that asset. And so people began to think, oh, this is safe. It's been packaged in such interesting and complicated ways. In fact, we'll give it a AAA bond rating. You know, this is a very safe asset. When in fact, if you went back through all the different people who purchased it and you went back to the original loan, this was not necessarily a safe loan. And so that securitization process where you take a bank loan and you turn it into a security, into a bond or some kind of securitized product, was at the core of the problem. It led to people forgetting to see what the underlying assets were that were backing these things, but it also led to a very kind of opaque process where once the crisis began to unfold, as the U.S. housing market began to sink, and people did begin to default on their mortgage loans, and so all these products which were backed by something suddenly were in trouble, nobody knew exactly who held which loans. They'd been packaged and sliced up and repackaged in such complicated ways that when you went to Citigroup, you know, one of the largest banks in the world, and you said, how much subprime mortgage exposure do you have? They could not give a straight answer. It took a very long time. And so that securitization process was at the core. Now, it's interesting for someone like me who had been following that securitization process is that there were some people warning about it. But interestingly, most of the experts who were involved thought it wasn't a bad idea. that the idea of taking bank loans and dividing them up and spreading them around the world, you know, groups as diverse as Norwegian schools were purchasing these things by the end, by 2006, 2007, that this was not a bad idea in the sense that it diversified risk. No, it's not a bad principle to diversify risk. And so I do want you to understand that there were some good ideas underlying what was going on, but it got clearly out of control. Now, that's the market side. They made a set of very serious mistakes. The regulators should have seen that. And when things were getting so crazy, and I'll give you an example of this, where once people began to be involved in these securitized products, they began to get so energetic about the new kinds of instruments that they developed that they began to lend with extraordinary leverage on the basis of these products. So, for example, UBS, which is one of the big financial houses, was lending with ratios of 100 to 1 at one point. In other words, you've got one, you know, dollar, and you're lending out $100. And the problem is not just that extremely high degree of leverage, but that you also, the $1 is not very safe to begin with. And so that kind of over-leveraging was something that regulators should have stepped in and said that is not allowed. You know, we control the way in which banks leverage as a way of providing some stability to the system, and there was a breakdown in that regulation. So one of the things that they were discussing in Washington last weekend is the need for regulators to catch up. So you catch up by making sure that when financial houses are doing this over-leveraging, they're not allowed. That you bring the leverages down to, you know, 1 to 10 or 1 to 12 might be a more appropriate ratio. You check out these securities products, these crazy new products that have been developed on the basis of mortgage products or other things, and you bring them under some degree of regulation. And all those things, I'm pleased to be able to say, have been agreed by the regulators, and now we're backed by the G20 leaders at the meeting last weekend. And there's all kinds of details. The French, for example, would like more regulation. The French would like to see banks regulated and investment banks regulated, insurance companies, and even hedge funds perhaps regulated, all kinds of institutions. In fact, they argue any financial institution which is highly leveraged should fall under some degree of regulation. And the Americans and the British, who've had a tradition of more hands-off regulation, have said, well, we don't want to go quite that far. We want to have them. So there's some disagreement, but there's a broad agreement on the general principle that you've got to tighten the regulations, catch up the regulations to what was going on in the markets. And one additional point I should mention on that first set of agendas is transparency. If there's one word that you hear the leaders say over and over again, it's that all of these actors who are in these multi-billion dollar markets must be more transparent when they're creating products, when they're borrowing, and even the bond rating agencies. You know, when they decide to rate something a AAA, why? You know, what was the basis on which they made that judgment? And historically, we have not regulated that kind of thing. And since they've made very gross errors over the past decade, the decision is made to try to force them to reveal the exact procedures by which they make those kinds of decisions. So transparency is a central principle. Okay, that's one set of things. I mentioned there are three, so let me go to the second one. The second cause, if you like, of the crisis is a set of people who came to the G20 meeting saying, well, it's true that regulations fell behind. That's the first agenda. But it's also true that we had a set of regulations that themselves revealed themselves to be problematic. That it wasn't just a question of not enough regulation, it was also the content of existing regulation. And what's the core problem here? The core problem is that the way in which we have developed international regulations of financial markets is that they tend to reinforce boom times and then reinforce busts. In other words, they are pro-cyclical. And this is a crazy situation. You want to have regulations do the opposite, that when you're in a boom time, the regulation slows down the boom. Central bankers often describe their own role. You know, when we're in a boom time, they begin to raise interest rates And they describe that as pulling the punch away from the party. You know, people are getting too excited, you've got to slow them down. And similarly, when you get into a bust, you want the regulators to be loosening things up in order that banks have some room to maneuver when they're experiencing some crisis. But we have had the opposite. And so this comes up in two ways. It has to do with the way in which international bank regulations have been developed over how much capital a bank has to hold. And the other area it comes up is with respect to accounting rules. And so if you follow the G20 meetings, you will have heard them talk a lot about those two things. How can we make capital requirements, and how can we make accounting rules, which sound extremely boring, but have enormous consequences on everyday life? How can we make those things more counter-cyclical? And this is something that I thought I would never see, I have to be honest. Because there's all kinds of reasons why it's difficult to do this, and there's all kinds of lobby groups who do not like to see this. I might say the bankers themselves don't like to see counter-cyclical regulation, especially in boom times, because you're essentially telling someone when things are good, we're going to cut back your profits. And so it's not popular for a regulator to do that. Remarkably, the G20 meeting did agree to look into how to rewrite these regulations in the accounting realm and with respect to bank regulation to make them be more counter-cyclical. So I think that was a really major accomplishment, and we'll see the details over the next year or so. The third and final item is the area where we've had the least amount of progress, and yet I think it's one of the more worrying aspects. And that's a set of problems around global imbalances. So if you look at the cause of this crisis, one cause of the crisis is that there was an excess of savings in one part of the world and a deficit of savings in another part of the world. And I'm sure you know which parts of the world are which. The deficit of the savings in the United States, which has been running current account deficits and had negative savings. And the surplus savings are in China, in Japan, and especially in the Gulf region. So some of the oil producers in the Gulf region. And those imbalances, something wrong necessarily with imbalances, but when they get so extreme, it can cause great instability in the world economy, and this is something that we experienced in the last decade. The specific thing we experienced is that the massive accumulation of reserve wealth, especially in a country like China, had the effect of the Chinese taking their wealth and investing it back in the United States, recycling the kind of surplus savings that they had. And that pushed down U.S. interest rates to very, very low levels. And when interest rates get very low, people borrow a lot and you get a kind of a bubble emerging. And we've experienced this many times in human history, and this was certainly one that we just went through. And so when you came to the G20 meeting, it was very tempting for the Americans to say to China and Japan and the Gulf states, you know, you are saving too much. And one way that we can get out of this crisis and make sure that it never happens again is that you must reduce your saving. And at the same time, those countries could say to the United States, you need to stop living beyond your means and raise your savings rate and reduce your consumption rate. And all of those things were right. But as you can imagine, these are difficult political things to do. You're asking for major restructuring in the economies of these specific countries. So in the case of China, you're asking the Chinese leadership to essentially reorient their economy away from an export-oriented development strategy, exporting to the U.S. market, the European market, towards a more domestic market, and you're asking the Americans to curtail spending and curtail budget deficits and other things that they've been running for some time now. And those are very difficult things to do. So nobody really anticipated an agreement at Washington. But what was a little bit encouraging is that in the lead-up to the meeting, the Chinese in particular announced a $560 billion stimulus package, which, the numbers get so large, they almost become meaningless at a certain level, but that is a very significant, that's about 10% of the Chinese GDP. So imagine the Canadian government launching a stimulus package of that kind. I mean, that's a major stimulus package. Now, some of it is previous spending, the usual government tricks that we don't know how much of it is new, but probably about 3% of it we think is new. And that's an important development. That's a signal that that the Chinese are giving to the world, that they're willing to boost their spending internally rather than have the economy so oriented towards exports. And so I was encouraged by that. Now, the other side of the imbalances is that once the crisis began to unfold, there were all kinds of countries around the world who really had nothing to do with the crisis. So I'm thinking of Ukraine, Hungary, Brazil, South Africa. These are countries which had no subprime mortgage problems. Their banks were not generally involved in these securitization processes. And yet once the crisis began to hit, they found themselves subject to capital flight, that all of the major banks in the world are pulling money back home to try to deal with their balance problems, their balance sheet problems, and there's a kind of a retreat to safe markets. And it's ironic to describe the U.S. as a safe market given the problems they've had, but it's relatively safe compared to other markets. And so suddenly a country like Ukraine or Iceland is the other dramatic example. You know, countries which seem to be not experiencing ever trouble suddenly have these very major balance of payments troubles. And that contagion effect has put those countries in a situation where they need foreign support, and they need it quickly, and they need a lot of it. And there's one organization in the world which can provide very quick funding for countries that experience balance of payments problems, and that's the International Monetary Fund, based in Washington, to which almost every country in the world is a member. And it's like a giant credit union. Everyone puts in some money, and when you hit a problem, you can pull out the money. The problem that we have at this particular moment is that the IMF only has about $250 billion worth of money. And again, it may sound like a lot to you, but it's not. You know, if we have several major countries experience a crisis, the IMF will run out of money. And so one of the things that was discussed in Washington was, how do we boost the resources of this institution? And the Japanese came to the meeting the day before the meeting. They said, we will give it $100 billion, no questions asked. We think this is a crisis, needs to be done. That was a remarkable statement to make. We hoped China might, because they have a lot of money that they could contribute, and they chose not to. And we hoped some of the Gulf states, some of you watching the news may have seen Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, traveling through the Gulf region asking for money. Can you please contribute some money to the IMF? And they've chosen to sit on their hands at the moment. And it's interesting to ask why countries have been resisting giving the IMF, especially countries with a lot of funds like China or some of the Gulf states. And I think the answer is fairly clear, that the IMF is perceived in much of the world still as a Western-controlled organization. And so you're being asked, if you're China, you're being asked to give a lot of your own money to an organization in which you don't have very many votes over how it makes decisions. And so there is a basic governance issue at this moment in human history for all international institutions. As we see changing balance of power, the rise of new powers and the decline of other ones, you need to restructure voting rules. You need to restructure the way these organizations are governed. And the IMF is one of the most important organizations that requires some degree of restructuring. Now, interestingly, certainly if you read some of the press, you'll see people describe the IMF as an American-controlled organization. And it's certainly true that the U.S. has a lot of control within the IMF. But in my mind, it's actually the Europeans who are the ones causing some of the trouble with the IMF. The Europeans have a larger voting share collectively than the United States. They control many of the seats that are the key governing council of the IMF, and they have to give them up. A country like Belgium has more influence in the IMF than China. This is a ridiculous situation. And so we need them to step up to the plate. What I would prefer to see is that the European countries, especially those that are members of the new common currency, the euro, that they take a single seat. You know, instead of having Italy represented, Germany represented, France and Belgium and all these countries, they just take a single one. And that would make the job of restructuring the governance of that institution a lot easier. But until that happens, and there was no decision made in Washington, until that happens, countries will be nervous about giving funds to that institution. And that nervousness, in turn, means that countries experiencing crises around the world are not going to have an institution to turn to. So that's a worrying situation. And what happened in Washington? They did agree. They said, we need to look at the governance, but there were no details exactly on how that would be done. And so that's presumably an agenda item for the next year. Okay, I see I'm running out of time. So let me just bring in Canada to this discussion, because I think it's important to know the role. Yeah. Oh, is that okay? Okay. 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 Are you sure? Okay. Well, I may say one additional thing then about that third point, if you don't mind, which is one scenario that I think a lot of people are worrying about coming out of the Washington meeting around the inability to reform an institution like the IMF quickly, is that it may be tempting for a country like China to say, well, we realize that the Ukraine is having trouble, or that Pakistan is another country experiencing trouble right now. It may be easier for us just to lend them money directly, or perhaps give some of our enormous sums to a regional organization in East Asia, which involves Korea, Japan, China, perhaps, but doesn't involve the United States or Europe, and give it to that kind of organization. And if, for instance, the Thai government has said to all countries in the East Asian region, why don't we all give about 10% of the reserves that we hold to a regional organization instead of the IMF, which is controlled by those Western powers? And I mean, if all East Asian countries give 10% of their reserves, you would immediately have a fund of about $300 billion, you know, an enormous fund, larger than what the IMF has. And that kind of thing is a bit worrying for someone like me who believes in international cooperation. And I worry about the kind of centrifugal forces that could be unleashed in this crisis. If you don't have rapid reform at the international level, you may get countries just going their own way and bypassing institutions that we've been trying to build since the Second World War to boost international cooperation. So that's just a final point on that third issue. Okay, let me turn to the Canadian role. You know, we in Canada like to think we're a very small country, we have no influence in the world, and it's, the world is run by the big players. But actually, this is a moment when Canada has been doing some interesting things. And I might mention that Canada has a long tradition of playing a leadership role in the governance of global finance. So the most important meeting that was created, it was in fact during the Second World War, to try to create the constitution of how the world economy would work after the war, was held at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in 1944. And the British were very important at that meeting, and the Americans were very important at that meeting, but it's often forgotten that the Canadians were widely applauded as having played a major role. And it's not so much that we had the money, it's that we had the ideas. And that one of the central figures at that meeting was a man called Louis Razminsky, who was applauded by all the delegates for having bridged compromises, brought new ideas to the table. I think Canada can play a similar role at this particular moment. Why is that? Well, Canada has a unique situation in the current crises. I mentioned, if some of you were at the talk last night, I mentioned that the Canadian banking system is regarded around the world not just as one of the most stable banking systems, it is regarded as the most stable banking system in the world right now. We are ranked number one. And it's because we have had a distinct tradition of how we regulate financial markets in this country. Our mortgage sector was regulated much more effectively than the American mortgage sector was regulated. Most investment banks in Canada are owned by the commercial banks who fall under certain regulations. And so if you watched in the United States when an institution like Bear Stearns suddenly got into trouble, or Lehman Brothers got into trouble, those were all independent organizations that were not subject to the usual kinds of regulations that cover commercial banks. That couldn't have happened in Canada. Those are covered by bank regulations. So we have a much more centralized system. Now, at different moments in Canadian history, people have said, well, that banking system is so conservative. It sort of doesn't seem to promote competition very well. And all of that is true. But at this particular moment, It looks very, very good. The lack of competition, if you like, the kind of oligopolistic nature and the conservative behavior of Canadian banks has actually been a savior in the current crisis. It's led them not to engage in the kind of risky behavior that some of our counterparts south of the border were involved in. And so people are looking at the Canadian experience and saying, how was it that this country, its financial system, is emerging relatively unscathed? We have some problems, but relatively unscathed. And so we have a moment. People are looking to us for ideas and for inspiration. So that gives us a kind of a unique position. I think there's one other reason why Canada has a particularly unique role to play at this moment, and that is that we are seen around the world as a country that often bridges the interests of the major powers, especially major Western powers, and the developing world. And it's a long tradition in Canadian foreign policy, and it's been particularly true in the financial realm, where if you go to an IMF meeting, you will see that there is a Canadian delegate around the key governing council, which has 24 countries represented there, and Canada is one of those 24 countries. But Canada sits in that position, not on its own. It sits there representing a constituency of countries which are largely developing countries, mostly from the Caribbean. And so even structurally, within the key institutions debating all these things, the International Monetary Fund, we even if we didn't want to, we are in a position of needing to represent both a rich country but also poor countries. That's our structural position within that institution. So it's given us a unique situation. If you have disputes, and we see these disputes emerging about how can the IMF be reformed, people look to Canada as someone who can bridge the two positions which often emerge. You see it also with respect to some other regulatory bodies. The Canadian government has been very strong in saying that all these bodies that govern accounting or that govern bank capital adequacy, all these things have been Western controlled. They must be expanded. They must bring in Brazil. They must bring in Mexico, South Africa, other countries which are emerging powers must play more of a role. And that was something Canada played a big role in pushing for before the Washington meeting, and that was successful. There has been a commitment in Washington to widen representation within those bodies. So I think this is a really important role that Canada can play at this particular moment. Okay, let me just try to quickly sum up that. I'm trying to convey to you what the major things being debated right now are. And one question you may have, and I look forward to questions in the question period, but let me just preempt one right away, is how is any of this going to help the situation at this particular moment? And it's not going to make the crisis go away. The crisis is, I dare to put a number on it, but perhaps halfway through. Let me just give you some examples. If you look at the subprime mortgages, a lot of those subprime mortgages had what were called teaser rates, where you took a loan, let's say you took a loan in 2005, and it looked like a fantastic interest rate. In 2 years' time, the fine print said the interest rate goes up dramatically. And that's one of the reasons why so many people are defaulting. They didn't realize the extent to which those teaser rates existed. Those mortgages were taken as late as mid-2007. Okay? So just count 2 years beyond. You know, we've got a lot of defaulting that's still going to happen up until mid-2009 and perhaps well into 2010, because often there's about a 15-month lag between the time when you first begin to experience mortgage payment problems and a foreclosure. That's a kind of average time. So we're not out of this in terms of its core. And the other more worrying thing is the extent to which the financial market problems are spilling now over into the real economy. So you see the problems in the auto sector and all kinds of different sectors as people get worried and pull back their consumption. So I don't mean to suggest that what was going on in Washington can solve that. It can't. There's a massive kind of deleveraging process that has to take place. Anytime you have a boom, a kind of a bubble, which is really what we're experiencing, it has to come down. It has to deflate in some way. And so nothing that Washington can be accomplished in Washington can make that go away. But what they can do, and this is what they're trying to do, and I think with some encouraging signs, is that they can both try to prevent it from happening again, and that's what rewriting these regulations and trying to get the regulations to catch up, and they can try to minimize the impact on everyday life. And so one of the things that we're seeing all governments around the world debating, and they certainly did this in Washington, was the extent to which governments may have to not just do what they have done, which is to bail out some of these large institutions to protect depositors, but also to engage in fiscal stimulus, often with deficit financing if necessary, in the old kind of Keynesian way. So those are the things that have been debated. I don't think that we will prevent future financial crises. Financial crises have been with us for 200-300 years, but we can try to minimize them, and especially minimize their impact on average citizens. So with that, I'll stop, and I look forward to your questions. But let's have something to eat first.
Thank you very much, Eric. So we'll have questions at right at 1 o'clock, and so we might have to eat a little faster.